Time is 4:59. Coming up next is your 5 o'clock news.
KVU Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KVU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from McMenamin's Barley Mill Pub, McMenamin's oldest pub, celebrating its 36th birthday Saturday, June 15th. The party will be going on all day, filled with Grateful Dead memorabilia and live music by the Garcia Birthday Band from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Open to all, and all ages are welcome at 1629 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. More information is available online at McMenamins.com.
Your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, another police shooting over the weekend.
We have a live interview with Mark Weisbrot to discuss the imaginary border crisis.
The Gulf Dead Zone is alive and well and larger than ever.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 10th, 2019. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Many tents went up at the Rose Festival on one day of the year when tents are legal. Many of the tents were pitched just to show how many homeless there are.
So a couple years ago, and I will tell you, I think it was around June 24th or so of 2017, I walked into Sisters of the Road for the first time, and it was life-changing. I decided I wanted to change the world. So one of the organizations that I joined was Right to Survive, and I told Ibram that I wanted to hire homeless people to pick up trash, okay? That all our jobs, we couldn't get jobs. So then you fast forward, and my friend Bob, who's recording me, he met this woman because he had a civil disobedience with the police about putting his bag of trash on their dumpster. Okay, which caught the interest of a lady named Taylor and a lover who also caught the love of Laura, and those are the people with Trash for Peace, okay? So we've developed a peer-run initiative, okay? This is completely peer-run. We don't need your name. We don't need anything. We don't care about your record, okay? This is for poor people. This is not just for housed people. This is for immigrants. This is for people that do not get jobs. Okay? A long time ago, when I was running a ministry house and I was still making a lot of money, that was my dream. I wanted to get jobs for people that could not get jobs. Our kickoff meeting is June 14th. I have some flyers for everybody. Okay? Tell people about it. This is important. This is a movement that we're doing. Okay? This is not, I mean, I'm really, really excited. Now, I want to tell you something, people. We can change the world. All I am is just a poor homeless person. And I, from my organizing, I'm going to go represent you guys with the Poor People's Campaign in Washington, D.C. I leave right after an event that I'm doing that day. I leave, go to Washington, D.C., and then when I'm done there, I'm going to the RAP face-to-face in San Francisco. This is serious. This is a movement. We're going to change the world, and Ted Wheeler can kiss us. I'm tired of being poor. I'm tired of telling them that we I'm tired of being told we can't buy our own land. We can't live in a tent. We can't live in a tent in our own city. My fiance says, I'm a Native American. I can live under this tree. It's my Religious Freedom Act this morning. As we were being swept. So seriously, people, let's do this together.
That outspoken woman's voice at the Rose Festival Tent City was captured by Jenka Soderberg over the weekend.
Declaring a trade war on other countries seems to be President Trump's go-to move when it comes to international relations. The most recent example is Trump's threat to set new tariffs on goods made in Mexico in an attempt to stop the flow of migrants across the United States' southern border. Fortunately, cooler and wiser heads prevailed from both sides of the aisle, and Trump backed off his threats. Still, Trump declared victory despite abandoning his losing strategy. To find out more, we're fortunate to have Mark Weisbrot on the phone with us now. Mark is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and the president of Just Foreign Policy. Mark's also the author of Failed, What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. Mark, welcome, and thank you very much for joining us from Washington.
Thanks for inviting me.
Mark, you published that recent article in the New Republic, Tariffs Are a Bad Response to an Imaginary Border Crisis. First, can you tell us why you call this an imaginary crisis?
Yes, well, it is a crisis for the migrants, of course. But that's a crisis that's actually created by Trump and not the one that he's talking about and filling the newspapers and all the media with this idea that, and he actually declared a national emergency, said that there's a crisis at the border because of migration itself, that that's the crisis. And the people, of course, are the crisis. And he's declared a national emergency both to get money for the wall and also for these tariffs. So that's really a fake crisis because if you just look at the data, from the U.S. government on immigration, and that's from Customs and Border Protection. They have a category called apprehensions and inadmissibles. It basically measures everybody who's trying to get across the border without authorization. And so that's been falling for 5 years. And in fact, in 2017, it hit almost a 50-year low. So when is it increased? Just 3 months. We've had 3 months of increase, and it's a big jump for 3 months. I mean, the average has gone from roughly 60,000 to 96,000, but there's no indication that that's going to persist. It could be a result of all kinds of temporary factors, and it probably will go down in the next 3 months. So there isn't anything there that would justify any measures to really try and force people not to come here.
Now, Trump threatened to set tariffs on Mexico and in the guise of a trade war. In your article, you make a strong point that this is really not about trade. What was his plan on the tariffs?
The tariffs were going to start in a week or so, and that was a 5% tariff and going up in increments, I think October, up to 25%. On all goods coming across the border from Mexico.
Okay, so what we have is Trump trying to resolve an imaginary crisis. So, I'm sorry, if you didn't hear me a minute ago, we just popped my mic on. So we have Trump who is trying to solve an imaginary crisis with an ineffective, even destructive policy. Now, do you think that he's misguided, or is this more of a deliberate distraction?
Well, I think all his trade wars are mostly distraction. It's the perfect distraction because we have trade with most of the countries in the world. There's 189 countries, so he can start one of these, anytime he wants. He had a whole bunch of them last year. I can't even name all of them between Europe and Canada and Mexico, China and South Korea. And so, yeah, and then he gets the claim victory. Which he did in Europe, he didn't get anything.
Right, right.
He never, he's going to do this again because these numbers will go down very likely in the next 3 months, partly because Mexico actually was taking measures to reduce the flow of migrants before he did any of this stuff, and partly because there are temporary factors that are that are pushing it up, including his own measures, because there's some people are started coming because they figured it was now or never. People who wanted to come were people fleeing violence in the Northern Triangle countries of Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador.
So in your opinion, what exactly is he trying to distract us from? I mean, I have some ideas, but in your opinion, what do you think it is?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there are, you know, he runs into trouble any day that he's not. This is how he ran his whole campaign. So he has a lot of things going on that are against him. Some of it, of course, is the Congress going after him, Democrats in Congress going after him for all kinds of things. I mean, he's got problems with corruption and using the presidency to favor his family business. There are, you know, the other parts of the potential impeachment, possible obstruction of justice, and you know, most of the country really doesn't like him at all. And so what he's doing, it's an unusual strategy actually for any president in the world, even most dictators in the world. He's not actually a dictator, but dictators even try to expand their political base outside of their loyal following. He doesn't do that. He does everything to play to that loyal following, the hardcore base that he can stir up with racist fears and animosities, in this case of immigrants, but he does other things that are similar. And, you know, I think the strategy comes from his trying to make sure that there aren't 20 Republicans who will defect in the Senate, so the base holds them in place. That's the number that would be needed to convict him if he were impeached in the House. That's where the strategy comes from. And obviously it's not a re-election strategy. At some point you would think he would change, but I've been thinking he would change since he ran his whole campaign for election on distraction. I never thought he would govern like that. But yeah, that's a huge part of what all these trade wars are about. He's going to switch to something else very soon.
Now, Mark, you mentioned distracting from what the Democrats are doing with the investigations into Trump's Russian ties, obstruction of justice, emoluments clause. But you also mentioned him trying to hold on to enough Republicans where 20 are not going to defect in the Senate and convict him of impeachment. However, this latest move to set tariffs on Mexico was met with a lot of Republican resistance. And then Trump tried to threaten them by saying it would be, quote, foolish to try to stop him, but that didn't even phase the Republicans. What was their response, and why were they objecting to this somewhat destructive policy?
Yeah, well, the Senate Republicans are looking at it. They don't really care about the migrants, or you know, even how it affects us, which isn't very much overall. But they care about the businesses and the supply chains and trade that we have in Mexico. I mean, 80% of Mexico's trade goes to the United States, and there are a lot of corporations, the Business Roundtable, the Chamber of Commerce, they really don't like this kind of stuff at all. And so, yeah, I think that's probably why he gave in, although he sees it as, of course, he won, and he's spinning it that way. But I think it was the business pressure. That's what's holding him back with the other trade wars as well, the one with China, because there's even more money that they're making there, and they don't want it. And that's the other part of his base, is the big contributors. I mean, you know, Sheldon Adelson is the reason that we have Bolton, for example. I don't think Trump would have even put him there. And so he's always playing off that base as well, which interferes with a lot of what he's trying to do for the less rich base that is going to hold the senators in line.
Mark, let's talk a little bit about the so-called border crisis and the underlying reasons for it. I know you touched on this in your New Republic article. What is really going on there?
Yeah, that's the other part I think doesn't get enough play in the media, although they do talk about it more than they used to. Well, you have the Northern Triangle countries, which have the highest homicide rates in the world, Guatemala and El Salvador, Honduras. And there the U.S. is responsible for an enormous amount of that. There was a coup, a military coup in 2009 in Honduras, and that coup was aided and abetted and consolidated with the help of the United States government. Hillary Clinton wrote in her memoirs, in the hardcover edition, she took it out of the paperback, but she did admit that she worked successfully to prevent the democratically elected president of Honduras from coming back to the country. And so and things have deteriorated enormously since 2009 there. And all these countries, I mean, look at El Salvador. You had the U.S. Role there, in, you know, from the 70s and 80s in horrible war, funding the military and death squads that killed tens of thousands of people. And then, of course, it was some of the people who left El Salvador and joined gangs in Los Angeles came back there and formed the two biggest gangs, who now become the largest employers in the country. They're so huge. And the violence there comes from the United States as well, Guatemala, and even longer history of U.S. sponsorship of violence through, you know, one administration after one dictatorship after another, all the way since the CIA-led coup of 1954, all the way to the 90s. And it was, you know, genocide determined by the UN. President Clinton actually apologized for the U.S. role in the genocide, which the UN commission determined that the United States actually did there. And so it's no wonder that these countries have these really high homicide rates and rates of violence that people are fleeing, not to mention all the economic damage and destabilization that it has caused along the way and all the way up to the present.
Oh, Mark, we just have about a minute left, but your article also goes into not just the damage caused by U.S. foreign policy, but you said that NAFTA, which went into effect in 1994, hasn't done any favors to the economy in Mexico.
No, and that affects Mexico in two ways. One, it consolidated all the terrible changes since the 1980s. As I pointed out, Mexico was a fast-growing country before 1980. If it had continued to grow at that rate before these reforms that the United States promoted, it would have European living standards today, and nobody would be coming here from Mexico, and even from Central America, they would stop in Mexico when they got there. So that's part of the economic damage that the United States has done. And then just one last thing is the financial instability that the U.S.-sponsored reforms have caused. You could see that in the 5% drop in the peso as soon as Trump did this, but you've seen this for years. Anything the United States does, the Federal Reserve does, for example, can cause terrible instability because Mexico has this hyper-mobile financial system, which again was a product of policies that were designed in Washington.
Well, Mark, thanks very much for joining us. It's an enlightening and very important article in the New Republic. I would like everybody to read it if they could get a copy.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
We've been talking with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and the president of Just Foreign Policy. You can find the article we've been talking about, Mark's article, in the June 5th edition of the New Republic. It's called Failed: What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy.
Two officers involved in a fatal police shooting in the Pearl District have been publicly identified. The shooting took place on Sunday at approximately 10 a.m. Officers arrived on the scene to find a man holding an injured woman at knife point. Police claim that the officers used less lethal weapons before Officer Nathan Kirby Glakowski shot the man, who died on the scene. The other officer, who used less lethal force, has been identified as Officer Jackson Oldham. The man who was killed has not been identified publicly. Neither officer was harmed during the confrontation. This is the third fatal Portland Police Bureau shooting this year.
Four Oregon public universities will defend tuition increases to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission on Thursday. Public universities in Oregon can independently raise their tuition by up to 5%, but higher increases need the HECC's permission. The Oregon Institute of Technology is asking for a 9% increase, with the University of Oregon proposing a similar 9.7% increase. Portland State University is petitioning for an even higher tuition hike at 11%. This leaves Southern Oregon University with the largest attempt at tuition raise, with a whopping 13.5%. Students across the state have pledged to challenge the increases, while university administrators say that if state lawmakers dedicated more money to universities, tuition hikes would be smaller with less of a burden on students.
California is on track to become the first state in America to offer health care to a number of immigrants who are in the country illegally. Democrats in the state legislature agreed that adults between the ages of 19 and 25 should be able to access Medi-Cal. That's the state's low-income insurance program. California Governor Gavin Newsom is prepared to spend $90 million a year on that program. According to the Associated Press, the new program could provide care for up to 100,000 low-income undocumented immigrants in California. The state legislature was initially considering a bill seeking to cover all undocumented immigrants who are living in California, those over the age of 19, but Newsom suggested the plan was unrealistic at this time. The measure has yet to be approved by the full legislature and then must be signed by the state's Democratic governor.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO's news in-depth conversation on what the White House has done to the EPA. Tonight's weather mostly clear with a low around 60, north northwest wind 9 to 14 miles per hour with gusts as high as 24 miles per hour. Tomorrow sunny with a high near 95, north wind around 10 miles per hour with gusts as high as 21 miles per hour. Today in history, 1940, World War II, the Kingdom of Italy declares war on France and the United Kingdom. U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt denounces Italy's actions, calling it a stab in the back. And in 1964, the U.S. Senate breaks a 75-day filibuster against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, leading to the bill's passage. Don't forget to visit our website, kboo.fm, and vote for KBOO. For the best radio station in Portland, if not the entire world.
The annual dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is expected to be the second largest on record. The dead zone happens when the water is depleted of oxygen. Without sufficient oxygen over a wide area, all marine life tends to perish. The area of this year's dead zone is predicted to extend over an area of about 8,700 miles. That's about the size of New Hampshire. This is nearly twice the size of the average dead zone. These dead zone events are mainly caused by agricultural runoff, especially nitrogen from fertilizers. The amount of runoff has increased this year due to the massive flooding of the Mississippi and other major rivers.
The Washington Post reported today that the White House barred a senior State Department intelligence analyst from issuing testimony to the House Intelligence Committee describing climate change as, quote, possibly catastrophic. The White House objected to references to the science around man-made climate change. Rod Schoonover was permitted to appear before the House panel, but his written testimony was blocked from being entered into official record. His testimony reads, "Absent extensive mitigating factors or events, we see few plausible future scenarios where significant, possibly catastrophic harm does not arise from the compounded effects of climate change." One of those who objected was National Security Council official William Happer, an architect of the Trump administration's climate policy and a known climate science denier who once compared the fight against climate change to the Holocaust. He reportedly said the report includes climate alarm propaganda and that the phrase "tipping points" is a propaganda slogan for the scientifically illiterate.
Jamie Sadler and Frankie Halperin of the American Waterworks Association have their report, This Week in Water.
This week ghost forests, that story, and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
There's a new face of the climate crisis, ghost forests, and they are as frightening as they sound.
Ghost forests are stands of dead trees which result from salt water getting into landscapes, and they're appearing up and down the eastern seaboard.
As sea levels rise, salt water seeps into coastal forest soil, and trees die from thirst. Their roots can't take up water with high salt content, and they grow weak.
Salt water also intrudes from farming practices. Starting in the late 1960s, developers built canals, pumps, and ditches across wetlands to keep farms dry. But drainage systems allowed salt water to flow inland, as Science Friday reports.
Emily Bernhardt of Duke University said that as sea levels rise and agriculture develops in coastal areas, these once rich carbon sinks have withered from the saltwater intrusion.
Popular Science reports that there are so many dead trees and stressed farmlands in the rural and low-lying areas between Massachusetts and North Carolina that signs of sea level rise are obvious. On the East Coast, sea levels are rising 3 times faster than the global average.
But the news may not be all bad. Salt-tolerant marsh plants move in as the trees die, and these coastal wetlands are valuable ecosystems. They filter out pollutants and nutrients from waters that flow into them and protect shores from erosion. They also store more carbon than forests.
However, researchers told Science Friday that while new species do move into ghost forests, some areas are not nearly as dense and productive as the forested wetlands they replaced.
When heat waves strike the southern U.S., they can be brutal.
And as a new study reveals, spikes in summer temperatures in the south are strongly associated with declining sea ice in the Arctic.
Sea ice is melting earlier in the spring and freezing later in the autumn. Each summer, it thins more and recedes farther, leaving greater expanses of the Arctic Ocean exposed to 24-hour sunlight.
The study, published in the Journal of Geophysical Research, looked at data over 40 years. The lead author said their research suggests declining Arctic sea ice is connected to extreme weather patterns across the northern hemisphere, and that if the decline of sea ice continues, more summer heat waves in the south are expected.
Just this past Memorial Day, the south was hit by a major warming that saw Fayetteville, North Carolina hit 100 degrees, beating its old record set in 1926.
On the topic of heat, there has always been some debate among crop experts and scientists about which of the challenges posed by the climate crisis is the greatest threat to U.S. agriculture, high temperatures or stress from drought.
Researchers at Cornell now say that heat stress or temperature will play a larger role than drought in reducing yields of several major crops later this century.
One of the co-authors of the study said that food-producing countries like the U.S. could become drier in the summer, even if rainfall increases.
That's because higher temperatures cause higher evaporation rates that could surpass increases in precipitation.
The study, published in Environmental Research Letters, says that under the mildest scenario, 6 crops, including corn, wheat, and soybeans, could decrease up to almost 20% relative to a world without climate change. And in the most severe scenario, the highest yields of those crops could drop nearly 50%.
In related news, temperatures in some areas of India reached 122 degrees Fahrenheit last week. For some 160 million people there, day zero has arrived.
Day zero was the term used when the South African city of Cape Town expected to run out of water, forcing taps to be shut off completely. It never arrived as robust conservation efforts worked to stave it off.
But India's day zero has come, with 10% of the population without access to clean water in or even near their homes, according to the Weather Channel. The crisis stems from excessive groundwater pumping, an inefficient and wasteful water supply system, and years of low rainfall.
A report by an Indian think tank describes how the crisis is likely to get worse. 21 major cities, including Delhi, Hyderabad, and Bengaluru, are expected to reach zero groundwater levels in 2020, affecting 100 million more people.
80% of India's average yearly rainfall comes from summer monsoons, which are already late in arriving.
Reuters reports that state governments have deployed tankers to ease water scarcity, but the tankers only come once a week, and on other days, hundreds queue up at wells early in the morning. And finally, Alzheimer's disease is a brain disorder that slowly destroys memory and thinking skills, and eventually the ability to carry out the most basic of tasks.
The causes of late-onset Alzheimer's, the most common form of the disease, are believed to include a combination of genetics, environmental factors, and lifestyle.
But according to a new study, one lifestyle factor you can control that might reduce your risk: brushing your teeth and flossing.
Scientists at the University of Bergen have DNA evidence that gingivitis bacteria move from the mouth to the brain, where harmful enzymes are excreted that destroy nerve cells, and they discovered the enzymes in 96% of people who had Alzheimer's.
The findings open a potential way to attack the disease, and they'll test a drug that blocks the process later this year.
The bacteria alone is not causing the illness, but their presence raises the risk for developing Alzheimer's and fuel its progression. The researchers say that people who have gingivitis, which is gum inflammation, or periodontitis, which is gum disease, and a family history of Alzheimer's should be sure to have their teeth regularly scaled and cleaned by a dentist.
As the German news outlet Deutsche Welle concluded, forget to brush today, forget a lot more later.
Hey, I have a t-shirt with that saying. Yes. Butterflies pollinate flowers and are beautiful to watch. Here's Nature Note.
This is Nature Note with Angela Gibbons of Earthwalk Vermont.
Today I'm feeling thankful for butterflies. Pearl Crescent, Baltimore Checker Spot, Morning Cloak, Hackberry Emperor. Can you picture any of these butterflies? With their extraordinary beauty, butterflies demand our attention. Also, we can thank them for being pollinators. Yes, while bees are better known pollinators, butterflies do their fair share. Other pollinators are beetles, birds, bats, and other small mammals. Almost 90% of plant species need pollinators to help them reproduce. Bees pollinate in smaller areas and are very good at what they do. Butterflies can travel longer distances, making sure to cover flowering plants in a much larger area. Butterflies tend to perch on large flower heads when they look for nectar, collecting pollen on their legs and body as they search for food. Even though less pollen collects on butterflies than it does on bees, they still are very effective pollinators. While bees buzz their way from flower to flower, butterflies glide and fly all around us, as if they know we are admiring how beautiful they are. What butterflies have you seen lately? Have you looked closely? Most likely you have seen the striking Canadian tiger swallowtail. This is a rather large yellow butterfly with black tiger stripes. Each spring and early summer, they fly over the hills and valleys of Vermont, sometimes in great numbers. Next time you see a butterfly, stop and look closely. Let's all learn more about and give thanks for these magnificent butterflies.
Nature Note comes to you weekly from earthwalkvermont.org and Goddard College Community Radio.
Devin Robinson, a 19-year-old black man from Detroit, has been charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder, 2 counts of assault, and other related weapons charges. Prosecutors say the victims were targeted by Robinson because of their sexuality or gender identity. Victims include Timothy Blanchard and Alunte Davis, both who identified as gay, along with Paris Cameron, a transgender woman. Blanchard died from his injuries, while the others survived the attack. Robinson has not been specifically charged with a hate crime. This shooting comes at a particularly devastating time, with June being Pride Month.
A newly released report of an analysis of federal data by NBC News says that 24 immigrants have died in ICE custody since Donald Trump was elected. That figure doesn't account for the deaths of at least 4 immigrants who died shortly after being released from ICE custody. It also doesn't include the deaths of those being held by other federal agencies, including the 5 migrant children that died while in the custody of Customs and Border Protection. Advocacy groups attribute the deaths to the substandard conditions in the more than 200 detention centers across the country. In a New York Times article released on Sunday, doctors who work with immigrants in ICE custody report that they're treated like felons. Conditions include expired food, unsanitary bathrooms, overcrowding, and the misuse of solitary confinement. An ICE spokesperson told NBC News that the in-custody deaths are exceedingly rare.
In Washington, D.C., House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler says he has struck a deal with the Justice Department to begin providing members of Congress with key evidence in the Mueller report. That's related to possible obstruction of justice by President Trump. The announcement comes before a vote set for Tuesday, where the House is expected to approve a resolution to go to court to enforce its subpoenas of Attorney General William Barr and former White House counsel Don McGahn. Nadler says the court fight is no longer necessary for the time being, but the vote is still happening. He goes on to say the committee would not take legal action against Barr unless the Justice Department stops cooperating. Details about which documents would be provided to the committee were not disclosed. The first documents under the deal were released to Congress today.
Prime Minister of Canada Justin Trudeau has announced that Canada will ban harmful single-use plastics as early as 2021 in an effort to reduce the 3 million tons of plastic waste tossed out by the country each year. According to the Canadian government, only 10% of plastic waste in the country gets recycled. Trudeau did not specify which forms of single-use plastics will be targeted, but many suspect plastic bags, straws, plates, bottles, and cutlery will be accounted for. Currently, reports indicate that there is 50 million tons of plastic in the world's oceans. Environmental experts say that plastic bags alone can take centuries to degrade. The new move by Canada comes after similar legislation was passed by the European Union and other nations. Trudeau's announcement was released just a few months prior to the country's next general election. Topics like climate change are expected to be among the top talking points on the campaign trail this autumn.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Manitoba have identified 17 children who were victims of abuse at a First Nation. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, two men have been charged.
According to police, several children between the ages of 3 and 15 were victimized between 2011 and 2017 at the Garden Hill First Nation. It's a fly-in reserve about 300 miles northeast of Winnipeg. Two men, a 21-year-old and a 20-year-old, have been charged with multiple counts of physical and sexual assault. A 66-year-old woman has also been charged with perjury and failure to report a child in need of protection or for providing that protection. The police investigation showed that the accused had access to the woman's residence, which was used as a foster home for scores of children. Police say as many as 150 may have had contact with the accused men. Here's Family Services Minister Heather Stevenson.
These are absolutely horrific allegations, and we take this extremely seriously, and we'll continue to work with our partners to ensure the safety of all children.
Police say the investigation is still ongoing. They're looking for other children who may have been victims, but they add that many have moved away. Officials are urging them to come forward and speak with investigators. Counseling is also being provided to the community and to police officers who worked on the investigation. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A settlement will allow a Native man to wear traditional regalia while serving prison time in Alaska. KMBA's Trip Krause talks with the ACLU about the impact the settlement will have on religious freedom in prison.
According to an ACLU news release, inmate Brian Hall wanted to wear a bear claw pendant and one of six bandanas. Casey Reynolds is a communications director for ACLU of Alaska. He says even inmates should have a First Amendment right to practice their faith in prison.
You have a right to do that so long as there's not a compelling government interest in stopping you, such as if it creates a safety concern or something along those lines.
While an inmate at Goose Creek Correctional Center, the civil rights organization says Hall made multiple requests to corrections officials. According to the ACLU, the Alaska Department of Corrections denied his requests. The state DOC said the items could create a safety risk.
So we filed suit on behalf of Mr. Hall, making it clear that the Department of Corrections has to respect everybody's religious rights, especially non-Christians like Native Americans and others whose requests may not be mainstream or may not be common.
The settlement also requires the DOC to adopt a policy to allow future religious accommodations to prisoners, according to federal law. Now 43 years old, Brian Hall continues to serve a 159-year sentence on murder charges stemming from a double homicide in Anchorage In 1993, he was transferred to Wildwood Correctional Center in Kenai, Alaska. Court records identify Hall as a member of the Cherokee Nation, but did not include specific tribal information. In Anchorage, I'm Trip Krause.
Tribal leaders and federal officials are holding the event Reclaiming Our Native Communities Tuesday in Arizona. It will focus on violent crimes, cold cases, and missing and murdered Native women. Officials from the Interior Department, Department of Health and Human Services, and the Administration on Native Americans will join state and tribal leaders for the event on the Gila River Indian Community. A new Arizona state law creates a study of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Other states are working on similar efforts, including in New Mexico and Montana. In Montana, the first meeting of a newly created task force to examine missing and murdered Indigenous peoples' cases is planned for Tuesday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 10th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jim Thompson, Kenzie Beard, Janka Soderberg, Ken Jones, and Barbara Bernstein. The producer is Jim Thompson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. At 6 o'clock after this newscast, join us for a conversation with economist Mark Brenner, longtime trainer and author, for a discussion about PERS. At 6:30 on Prison Pipeline, Emma Lugo talks with Tricia Swanson about the Women's 5K Running Club Reason to Run at Coffee Creek Women's Correctional Institution. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio captures some of the speeches made this weekend at Oscar Grant Mural. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, we respectfully request that you go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. By the way, while you're there, don't forget to vote for KBOO for the best radio station in Portland. Coming up directly after this newscast, you'll want to stay tuned for KBOO's In Depth with Barbara Bernstein. She'll be in conversation about what the Trump administration has done to the Environmental Protection Agency. And finally, don't forget to floss, because if you forget your teeth now, you'll forget a lot more later.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. President Donald Trump delivered his budget roadmap with a promise to balance the budget in 15 years. And once again, the Environmental Protection Agency found itself in the Trump administration's crosshairs, with the White House proposing to slash its budget by 31%. With this budget, Trump continues his unprecedented assault on protections for clean air, drinking water, national parks, and border communities. Today we talk with former EPA staffer Betsy Sutherland, who resigned in August 2017 when it became painfully clear that the EPA she had worked in for 40 years was being gutted by the Trump administration. She's still raising her voice against Trump's refusal to protect the American public from environmental hazards. Betsy, welcome to Locus Focus.
Well, thank you for having me today.
Well, in preparing for this interview, I came across an article that was in ProPublica at the end of 2017, and it talks about your fight. It was, I guess, one of the last fights that you did at the EPA to protect an effluence regulation that had been 10 years in the making. So I want to, before we go into these recent budget cuts that Trump is proposing, talk a little bit about the atmosphere at the EPA and how it changed when Trump became president, because you actually had a very long history there, long before he came into office.
Yes, and I have worked under, of course, both Democratic and Republican administrations, and we certainly saw a difference in the past when you went from a Democrat to a Republican administration, but nothing like this. This was a wholesale repeal of all the previous environmental protections that been put in place, not just to protect the lovely environment that we have, but also really directly impacting public health protections. And we found that it was being done at the request of really just a few of the political donors to the Trump campaign, not even supported by most of the industry people that they purport to be, advocating for.
So who are some of those donors?
Bob Murray of Murray Energy is one of the largest coal barons in the country, and he personally gave President Trump a three-page action plan that listed every single environmental regulation that he wanted repealed and a number of other requirements for coal mining that was done by the Department of Interior and the Energy Department. And right now, the Trump administration is on track to satisfy every one of his requests.
Who else besides Bob Murray? I mean, we often hear about the Koch brothers. I wonder how much they have influenced some of these policy changes.
Well, the big influence from the Koch Industries and also Marathon Petroleum, they are really seem to be the ones behind the Trump administration's repeal of the Obama administration's gas mileage rules. This is the fuel economy rule, where we were going to have, under the Obama administration rulemaking, a progressive increase in the gas mileage that cars and light trucks would have to have. And they have proposed to freeze that at the 2020 levels and not to go any further. Right now, we know that there's been almost all of the automakers have protested that and said that they were going way too far. Honda and Ford, in particular, have disavowed EPA's plan to freeze this gas mileage. And all of the automakers have been very open about the fact they're quite concerned that the Trump administration is planning to remove California's ability to set more stringent standards, which would then, you know, make sure the entire country is on this very frozen, low gas mileage situation.
Actually, what is the importance of California's having had for, I guess, what, like at least 40 years now, more stringent environmental protections than other states in the country?
It's really been very influential. A number of the states, there's actually 13 other states and the District of Columbia that have been following California's lead. And what California has done is really been an innovator, pushing forward the whole automaker industry in the United States to be more and more environmentally conscious. So even when the federal government has not wanted to go as far, having California out there has been really a spur to reducing not only the petroleum purchases by every consumer in the country, but greatly reducing the carbon dioxide emissions that are causing our terrible climate change situation.
So when Trump first became president, I'm being kind of a hopeless optimist. I kept thinking, well, he can't change all these rules because the rulemaking process takes a long time to happen. And what he wants to do, and he's getting rid of these rules, is he has to go through another rulemaking process. But in reading more recent articles, it sounds like he's actually done a bit of damage already. How much of the Obama-era regulations have actually been gutted, and how much of that is just still in process or being litigated?
Well, he has, in the first 2 years, he actually repealed over 40 of them. Of those 40 that he's repealed, he's got another 40 that he's planning for the next 2 years. So there will be entirely a total of 80 environmental regulations that are either going to be blocked, delayed, or targeted for repeal. Now, the way that this is clearly, for just a common sense approach, the fact that every one of these 80 regulations usually took about 6 to 8 years to develop, the fact that he could repeal all of them in 4 years clearly indicates that he is not doing this based on science and engineering and economic fact. He is doing it strictly at the request of his donors. Now, right now, we have more than 140 lawsuits have been filed against EPA, but there's only been 27 cases that have reached a final decision to date. And EPA has lost every one but one of those. So they lost 26 cases and only won out of everything that's been litigated to date.
Now, what does it mean by that they've lost it? Is EPA on the side of Trump now, or is EPA still fighting?
Yes, EPA is on the side of Trump. So what has happened is, with that terrible litigation record, that has given hope to every environmental and state attorney general in the country, because we have found that they have been so quick to repeal years and years of regulatory work, that they have not in turn done the adequate science and engineering and economic analysis that justifies those repeals. So when it finally gets to a judge, they're losing one after another. And again, so far the total is they've lost 26 out of 27 lawsuits.
So my optimism is well-founded. That's kind of good to know. Continue, Sharon.
It's good to be optimistic about the final outcome of the litigation, but you have to realize all of us are experiencing much higher levels of pollution in our air, water, and land during the years that it takes for these court cases to get filed and decided, and then for the environmental and public health protections to be put back in place. So all of us are experiencing real threats to our public health over the next 4 to 8 years while all this litigation takes place and hopefully is resolved somewhere around 2024.
So it seems like there's a couple of different classes, I'm assuming, that there's regulations that were decided during the Obama years but had actually not taken effect yet. But is Trump also trying to repeal regulations that have been on the books for a long time? And I'm wondering about the difference. If a regulation is already on the books, is enforcement ability gutted during the whole litigation period?
That's what he's trying to do. And the one that's the clearest example is the one that he now has proposed to repeal and to adjust, and that's the mercury and air toxics rule. And that rule went into effect in 2012. The entire electric utility sector is opposed to the Trump administration's proposal to repeal this rule because all of them have long since been in compliance. They all agree that mercury and other air toxics pose very serious public health threats. But in this case, Bob Murray, again, the CEO of Murray Energy, has demanded that that rule be repealed. And so the Trump administration is in the process of doing that.
So
that rule was final in 2012.
So while that rule is being appealed or trying to be repealed, has it stopped being in effect?
What they have said is right now the electric utility industry, who themselves are opposed to this repeal, they're continuing to operate their air scrubbers to remove mercury and these other air toxics from their emissions. What the concern by Bob Murray is pushing for this to be repealed is that in the future, if this repeal were to go final, people could decide to just turn off the operation of these air scrubbers. It would save them a lot of money. And of course, what Bob Murray is trying to do is to encourage new coal-fired power plants to be put in place. And of course, any new plant would never have to have complied with this rule if it's been successfully repealed. So Bob Murray's trying to keep coal-fired power plants operating because he sells coal.
Let's talk a bit more about this Bob Murray. I mean, his name rings a bell to me. Some people probably have never heard of him, though. Where is he from, and what's the extent of his holdings?
His holdings, he really runs the coal mines in much of Appalachia. And there are two uses for coal. One is to make steel, and right now that's the one that has some promise because there's a lot of coal exports to China and India and other countries that are in a big building phase. And so they need what's called metallurgical coal to make steel. But his big customer base originally was coal that is burned for power. And he's selling that coal power plant to companies around the country. And of course, that has had enormous decline. They're down to I think they're down to about 30% or less of the U.S. power plants now are fired by coal. And so he wants to reverse that trend and have it go back to coal being one of the main power supplies in the country.
Well, it's kind of interesting because it's the common wisdom is that coal is going out of style, so to speak. I mean, here in the Northwest, all the coal fire plants are going to be closed in the next 2 to 3 years. Though, interestingly, I did see a coal train the other day as I was crossing the Columbia River, and it looked like it was heading west, and I'm assuming it was probably going up to the Centralia coal-fired plant there. But coal is really, like, in many parts of the country, or at least on the West Coast, it barely exists anymore. And gas is unfortunately seeming to be its replacement, and that's a whole other issue. But it seems that Murray and his allies are actually fighting a real losing battle.
There's no question about that. The Trump administration just tried to stop the Tennessee Valley Authority, you know, which is a government-owned utility, from shutting down several of their coal-fired power plants. And even the TVA people turned them down because these old plants are simply not cost-effective to run anymore. And you're right, in most cases, they are being replaced with natural gas plants. But at the same time, the coal themselves, no one wants to run these plants anymore. They're very expensive, and it's not, in most cases, the environmental regulations which are encouraging the utilities to shut them down. It's actually the cost of operating them.
So why is it that while the industry is by and large opposed to these cutting back and repealing of regulations that have been long in the making to protect our environment and our public health, if they're so much opposed to it, why is it that a few loud voices that have Trump's ear are able to override the will of most of the American business?
Because they are the ones who have donated to his campaign. In many cases, they're the ones who have supplied the political appointees to the Department of Energy, the Department of Interior, and to the Environmental Protection Agency. So their voices are the only ones that the Trump administration is listening to. And I can tell you that that is what the shock was at EPA. We realized within the first 6 months of the Trump administration at EPA that this was going to be unlike any other previous Republican administration. It is solely controlled by the political donors who provide all of the funding for his campaign and apparently provide all the source of his political appointees. So it's a very, very corrupt situation.
Yeah, he's been draining the swamp all right there. Today we're talking with former EPA staffer Betsy Sutherland, who resigned in August 2017 after Trump took over, or Trump's cronies took over the EPA and transformed its mission from protecting the health and environment of the American people to basically destroying it.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Road to the Green New Deal Town Hall on Sunday, June 16th at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Sunrise Movement PDX hosts the Portland leg of the National Road to the Green New Deal Tour, featuring local activists like Antonio Zamora of For the People, community leaders, and key political players Representative Blumenauer and Senator Merkley. All will discuss the plan for tackling the climate crisis and creating jobs in the process. Again, that's the Road to the Green New Deal Town Hall on Sunday, June 16th at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a news and public affairs director to manage the evening news and public affairs programming and to train and supervise volunteers. For this full-time position, we're looking for someone with proven experience in news and public affairs production, management and supervisory skills with volunteers with an emphasis on teamwork in a collaborative setting, and ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. People of color and women are encouraged to apply. The deadline to apply is Monday, July 1st at midnight. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
Get out! Fight! Trouble in the streets! Watch out! Right! Jambice on the way! Get out! Fight! Trouble in the streets! Watch out! Right! Jambice out to stay!
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, it's Labor Radio with Stephen Siegel interviewing economist Mark Brenner. Then it's Prison Pipeline at 6:30 and then Hard Knock Radio at 7 o'clock.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, Stephen.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today on the phone is Mark Brenner. Hey, Mark, can you hear us all right? Mark, can you hear us? Okay, I think I heard you that last time. You there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Yes.
There we go. We're yeah. in business.